This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1864, the H.L. Hunley was the first combat submarine to sink a warship. It brought down the USS Housatonic, which was part of the Union blockade of Charleston. But the Hunley was lost as well, and to this day, no one is sure why. Rachel Lance is a recent graduate of Duke University's Pratt School of Engineering and an instructor of biomedical engineering at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And she thinks she solved the mystery. She's devoted hundreds of hours to cracking the case and is willing to share her theory today. Rachel Lance, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're going to find out more about kind of what happened. But I think if anybody knows anything about the Hunley, they know that it's a submarine. It's a Confederate submarine and sort of one of the first to be used in battle, the first to sink an enemy warship. But describe this thing, because here's what I never knew about this, was kind of how small it was and how it worked. Maybe you can describe the submarine and how it moved through the water.
Yes, so this was really the early days of submarine technology. So it was the first submarine that was successful in combat. It was about 40 feet long, and it was actually shaped out of the reused boiler of an old steamship. So it was a bit of recycling happening there. Yeah. And it was less than 4 feet wide, and it was vaguely cylindrical, so it's just a little bit over 4 feet tall. What's really interesting to me about this submarine is that it was hand-powered. So there were 8 men inside total, one that was piloting the boat, and then the other 7 were stationed along a hand crank, and rotating the hand crank was what turned the propeller on.
They were pistons. They were human pistons. There was like a crankshaft, and you'd each have the upper and the lower side by side, and you'd just be rolling your arms.
Exactly. And they were all offset, so they would have had like a camshaft motion.
And then the guy strapped in the front with his hand on the wheel.
Yep, pretty much.
Wow. So that's how it works. Now, the other question we have to have is, sort of the theory of this thing in terms of how it's going to bring down vessels. And this is interesting, too, the way in which it could hurt an enemy vessel. Tell us how it worked.
So actually, how it worked exactly was one of the interesting discoveries that the archaeologists of Clemson made as they started conserving it. A lot of the historical accounts had stated that it towed a torpedo behind it on a rope. So during the Civil War, a torpedo was stationary. It's not like we think of them today. It couldn't propel itself. It's more of what we'd think of as a floating bomb. Mm-hmm. And it would tow this torpedo far behind it, dive under the enemy ship, raise itself up on the other side of the ship, and then continue to move forward as it pulled the torpedo against the enemy ship's hull.
Sounds like a crazy idea, but keep going.
Okay. Oh. So we know that they tested this design successfully a couple of times on just like barges and things they were willing to blow up.
Yeah.
But it had a common problem where the rope would get tangled in the propeller. So for their final mission, they went to a different design. They had a spar, and it was 16 feet long. So they attached the spar to the front edge of the Hunley, the bottom front edge of the bow there, and it had the torpedo attached to the other end of the spar. So they had 135 pounds of black powder, so it's about the size of a beer keg. And they're only 16 feet away.
16 feet away from the thing it's going to be on your boat when it hits their boat.
Right. Okay. So then they approached the hull of the Housatonic and basically just jabbed it with their torpedo, which was pressure-driven detonation.
So. All right. And so that worked, turns out. Brought down the Housatonic.
Yes, it did. It sank the Housatonic. It caused sufficient damage that the whole boat, which was it was actually a rather large ship, but it sank within 5 minutes.
All right. So that is successful. And as far as we know, the first time a submarine successfully brought down an enemy ship. But then that's the last we heard of the Hunley, right?
Correct. Yeah. So it disappeared after that. And there were 2 people at the time who sort of claimed that they had seen the Hunley's prearranged signal for victory. But there are some doubts about those accounts. The eyewitness testimony, one of them was a guy who'd been clinging to the rigging for almost an hour in near freezing weather after being blown up. So the Hunley basically disappeared, and it was found in 1995. And then in the year 2000, once all the paperwork had been done for who owned it and where it was going, they brought it up and started conserving it down in Charleston, South Carolina.
All right. So any clues now to the mystery of why it went down? Just talk about where it was found and what that told folks about this whole episode.
So where it was found was really interesting, and it was a big factor of why it was not found for such a long period of time. People had looked for it after it sank the Housatonic in the 1800s, but they had all looked between the Housatonic's wreck site and shore. So people knew where the Housatonic had sank. Its rigging had still been sticking up out of the water. It was only in 30 feet of water. So the Hunley itself actually ended up being found seaward, and that's why it took so long to discover it. It was found about 310 meters away, and because it was found so far away, and based on the general shape of the boat, we can conclude that it needed to have drifted for quite a while after it sank. So that in itself is pretty interesting and eliminates some of the theories, because if it had started sinking right away, it would have been found much closer to the Housatonic.
Right. And if they were alive in the immediate aftermath, they probably would have been pedaled into shore.
Exactly.
But they were in the opposite direction. And you can take a look at the sea currents and the currents and things at the time, and that would at least give a plausible explanation for why they were in the other direction.
Exactly.
Not under power. Yep. All right, well, let's talk about the theories then. What were people saying about how... about why it went down.
So one theory was called the lucky shot theory. As the Hunley approached the Housatonic, the crew on deck of that ship knew it was coming. They spotted it. It was too close to train their cannons on it, but they had personal firearms, and so they were firing at the submarine as it approached. The lucky shot theory stated that one of them managed to hit the hull in such a way that it sank the submarine, or that it managed to shoot through one of the little deadlight windows and kill the lieutenant who was piloting it. If it had sank the submarine directly, by definition, that submarine would have been found right next to the wreck site of the Housatonic. And there were no remnants of a bullet casing found inside the submarine or any indications that crewman had in any way been shot. So I did some ballistic testing with other researchers as part of my PhD, and we also showed that any of the damage to the conning tower didn't really match the ballistics that would have occurred. The other more plausible theory was that they suffocated inside the closed hull. So they got oxygen by opening the hatches of their two conning towers and just basically letting the boat refresh from the atmosphere outside. When the boat was found, the rear conning tower was still locked. So they had not only made no effort to move from their seats, they didn't make any effort to even open the hatch.
And forgive me, it's not in very deep water. So the idea of being able to get up to the surface to open those hatches wasn't far-fetched. They were only in 30, 40 feet
correct.
Of water, right?
Yeah, they were only about 35 feet of water where the boat was finally found. And they also had the ability to release all of their weights from inside the vessel, and they didn't make any effort to do that either. So I did some math and looked at the volume of gas inside of the submarine and combined that with things that we know from just general respiratory physiology, which obviously has many decades of research, and concluded that they would have had at least 10 minutes of warning before they ran out of air. What would have given them the warning was the buildup of carbon dioxide inside that closed hull. Carbon dioxide has some very uncomfortable and noticeable symptoms. I've experienced it. It is not pleasant. And you definitely have this sensation that you're continuously gasping for breath. And it also has some physical discomfort, too. So the fact that they would have experienced that and then had at least 10 minutes to take corrective action and they didn't really indicates that that theory isn't plausible either and that their demise was a lot more sudden.
So what do you think happened?
Well... what I think happened, and I am biased, I did write a paper on it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like you came to it with a prejudice. You actually tested this theory. Go ahead.
So this was the subject of part of my PhD dissertation. I, along with other researchers, of course, nobody stands alone in science, but we built a scale model of the Hunley, and it was a 1/6 scale model, so it was about 6.5 feet long, and we exposed it to scaled black powder charges. What we showed was that the pressure from those charges propagated inside the hull of the boat at a level that was sufficient that the crew inside would have experienced fatal injuries from blast trauma. So what that would have appeared like to them is they would have had immediate pulmonary and brain trauma resulting from those high pressures.
I mean, does that mean that the shock waves actually sort of went from the hull of the Housatonic, right? That's where the charge led off. Now you got shock waves, I assume, going in all directions.
Yeah, it's pretty omnidirectional. It would have actually been stronger in the direction of the Hunley because it would have had a reflection off of the Housatonic. So they kind of, there's no way they would have had the blast knowledge to really understand that phenomenon at the time. But they inadvertently set themselves up for sort of a perfect storm of blast exposure.
And tell us then how this works. It's shock waves that then make their way through the hull of the Hunley and into your body. And your lungs are exploding from this? What's happening?
So it's not really an explosion. What happens is the pressure wave for black powder, it's a pressure wave, not a shock wave. It's an industry term. It's very small difference. I won't get into it. But,
I might ask you to explain, but tell me what happens to my lungs.
So when the pressure wave enters your body is mostly water. So it's traveling very quickly, like sound travels quickly through water. Mm-hmm. When it hits the lungs are this mixture of air and water. And that frothy mixture of the two actually slows the pressure wave down even more than it would if it was just traveling through normal air. So in your body, it's going about 1,500 meters per second. And then when it hits your lungs, it's forced to slow to about 30 meters per second. Wow. So all of that energy from that traveling pressure wave has to go somewhere. So basically what ends up happening is that wall of the lungs takes the energy from it and it ruptures the blood vessels. So that's where you get one of the characteristic injuries of blast trauma, which is something we call blast lung. And it shows up as x-rays as just these patchy areas that have been filled with blood.
All right. And, of course, there's no soft tissue that survives, so we can't look at the lungs of the crew.
Right. Unfortunately not, no. Yeah. We would have had to do an autopsy right after the fact, which was not an option.
It was not an option at the time. We didn't find it for 130 years, so you couldn't even find that ship. And also brain trauma as well.
Yes. So brain trauma is a possibility as well, a strong possibility as well. We calculated about a 32% chance of fatal brain trauma. And what that would do, that's a different mechanism, but what that does is it typically leaves the brain intact, but then you have bleeding on the surface of the brain, so you have a hematoma. And that can also cause fatalities as well. So it's possible they died from either or both at the same time.
I'm going to take you off on a little bit of a tangent, but one of the things we're learning from our recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, because of better body armor, we're finding that returning vets who may have been exposed to an explosion of some kind, an IED, they may have been hundreds of yards away, but they're experiencing some of these kinds of tissue damage, and I think it's for roughly the same reason, and there's none of the symptoms because their bodies weren't affected by it. There was no bleeding, there was no tissue damage at the surface, but soft tissue damage inside.
Yes, exactly. And so that was actually something that was studied as part of the PhD dissertation of one of the people who came out of my same lab at Duke. His name is Garrett Wood, but body armor, the way that it's currently built by America, has the somewhat unattended positive side effect of protecting the lungs from blast injuries because of the materials it's constructed out of. So these personnel who are coming back, who are having traumatic brain injuries, they're seeing that occur clinically because their lungs are being protected. Mm. So that would have most likely otherwise been a fatal exposure. And that's why in this war, we're seeing such a prevalence of that specific injury type.
Interesting. They're making it back. So now back to the Hunley. What got you involved in this and doing all these experiments and pretty much obsessed, right? I mean, you were obsessed with this.
Yes, you could say that. Okay. I think with a project like this, you have to be a little bit obsessed because if it was easy, it would have already been done.
That's true.
So this actually started as a little bit of a tangent. I had been looking at blast injuries to unprotected swimmers in the water, and I have always just had a really strong love of history. My advisor, Dale Bass, has shared that love of history, so that's something that he and I had always talked about just recreationally at work. He wandered in my office one day and he asked if what I had been doing, look at these unprotected swimmers, could be applied to the submarine, the Hunley. And I honestly didn't know what that was at the time. I had to look it up. But then the more that I learned about the case, the more that I realized that it did in fact have the hallmark of just conventional blast trauma. And the amount of exposure that they received from such a large charge being so close seemed to me to present the first case of this type of blast transmission mm-hmm. happening.
And you have done quite a bit of experiment. You talked about building a replica, right, in the first place. Then you had to kind of simulate a scaled-down charge. You also used a period rifle to test the lucky shot theory. Is that right, too?
Yes. We used a period-accurate rifle. It is a replica. It's no longer safe to fire the originals because of changes that happen to the metal. But there is a very nice Civil War reenactor who is kind enough to bring his firearm with him. His name is Chris Kelly, and help us do a lot of that ballistic testing.
What happened to submarine warfare? I mean, it seems to me if that was the problem, it would have happened over and over again if they hadn't figured out how to shoot, you know, torpedoes out of the hole.
So that's actually a question I get asked a lot, especially with regards to depth charges. And what you have to look at is the next real submarine warfare we see is in World War One. So there are about 50 years of technological development and design changes in between there. And one of the things that people immediately started doing was trying to make submarines able to go to deeper depths. To do that, they made these hulls a lot thicker. And I've actually done the math on this. It's hard to describe math over the radio. But basically, as soon as people started building those pressure hulls thicker, they dramatically reduced the amount of blast that could even be transmitted at all. And I mean, we're going from about 8.5% for the Hunley to literally 0.01% for submarines during World War II or World War I.
And I'm guessing the technology for discharging is a little bit different. I don't have to be attached to the blast anymore.
Correct.
I can kind of put some distance between you and the target.
Yeah, they've improved on that design of the long poking stick.
Because the Confederacy actually pulled the plug on it. We should point out that the Hunley actually sunk and lost its crew twice before this, before seeing battle, right? These were in tests.
Correct. Yes. During practice and testing, the Hunley had sunk twice before. And there were some survivors to one of them. But overall, those two sinkings had lost 13 men. And so for that reason, in the final mission, it was specified by the commanding officers in Charleston that everyone in the boat that night had to be volunteers.
Oh. And you said they were abnormally tall for that period, which is strange thinking about the size of that ship.
They were. I'm not quite sure where the logic from that came from, but some of them were over 6 feet.
So there is pushback now. This is not the settled theory. You're still one of a number of theories, right? Where does it stand now? And because it's a fairly robust debate at this moment, is it not? You're convinced, I know. And it's convincing. It's persuasive because not only does the math add up, but then the aftermath as well. The idea that the ship would have, if they had died instantly, but it didn't sink instantly, then it would have drifted to that location. So
right.
You've got a lot going for you.
So here's the thing, is there has been... there was a press release issued that argued with my findings in a way. The problem is for me as a scientist, I'm very happy to debate data and theories and methods of analysis. And that's part of the reason why for this project, I wanted to publish in an open access journal that allows free download of the paper, but also free download of all of my data. All of my data is out there and can be downloaded by anybody. The problem with the response that I've been receiving is that it doesn't actually address anything I've said in the paper, any of my data, or any of how I've analyzed it. So it's very difficult to start an actual scientific discussion from that perspective. In addition, one of the things that they've mentioned is refuting my study was a web report that was published several months prior does not actually discuss my study at all and talks about a completely different theory. It's about a theory that they all had blunt force trauma to the head, which I agree is also unlikely. So, yeah, it's been an interesting experience watching the response.
I've got about 20 seconds left. Are you still on this or have you moved on now?
I've mostly moved on. If someone is willing to fund me building a full-size submarine, I'm happy to do the tests. But
that's Rachel Lance. Yeah. You can find her through the station or at our website, stateofthings.org. Recent graduate of Duke University's Pratt School of Engineering and instructor of biomedical engineering at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was lovely being here.
Just ahead, we stay in the 1860s and look at the bizarre true story of a little town in New York State that seceded from the Union during the Civil War and was also one of the last stops on the Underground Railroad. We'll find out more about that on the State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned.